We are joined by Douglas Preston. He's the New York Times bestselling author and writer of The Lost City of the Monkey God, A True Story. Douglas, it's so nice to have you here. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Well, thanks.
Douglas, can you tell us a little bit about what is the Lost City, or the City of the Monkey God, the White City? It's got so many different names. What is this Lost City that your book is all about?
Well, it's incredible to think that in the 21st century, you might actually be able to find a lost city somewhere on the surface of the earth. But that's exactly what happened, using very high technology. And I wrote a book about it. And I tell the true story of this amazing discovery. It's actually a legend. The Lost City of the Monkey God, or the White City, La Ciudad Blanca, is a legend that has been bouncing around Honduras since the time of Cortez. And a lot of crazy people have searched for this city. Fraudsters, con men, archaeologists, and many of them lost their lives in the effort. But in 2012, the city, a great lost city, was actually found in the Honduran jungle in an unexplored valley using the technology of LIDAR.
Awesome. We're going to learn all about this technology that was used in order to find the lost city. Can you tell us a little bit about your team and how you got involved in this?
Well, I got involved about 20 years ago when I was at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. I was interviewing a scientist who was an expert in remote sensing of the Earth from space, a guy named Ron Blum. And I was for something entirely different, and he happened to let slip that he was working on a secret project looking for a lost city. And as a journalist, I was all over that, and I started pressing him to tell me more about it. And that's how I met this guy named Steve Elkins, who was a filmmaker who was obsessed with finding this lost city. And he was going to find it, and he was going to capture the discovery on film. And he had hired Ron Blum sort of to moonlight for him, him and his team, to moonlight for him, looking at satellite imagery and radar imagery of Honduras from space in this one particular area of Honduras called La Mosquitia, which is one of the largest and the wildest and most dangerous mountainous jungle areas in the world.
Wow. And how, and now when you got involved, did you have the inclination, did you think that we were going to find this thing, or was it more just for the adventure? I would think,
well, you know, I'll be honest with you,
people have been looking a long time here, Douglas.
I'll be honest with you, I thought it was going to be a really funny story about yet another crazy search for this non-existent lost city. And I really believe that. I mean, I love Steve. He's a great guy. But, you know, he's like an obsessive. And I thought, well, you know,
it'll be a funny story
if they don't find the city, which I was sure they wouldn't find. It's going to be a very funny story. Mm-hmm. And if they do find the city, well, I'll be the luckiest journalist in the world.
Right.
And in 2012, finally, they found actually not one but two lost cities using this technology. I was completely blown away. And I really couldn't believe it when I first laid eyes on those images of those pyramids and plazas and roads and everything.
I want to talk a little bit about this technology that you were kind of alluding to. But, you know, the people have been looking for this lost city since when, 1500s or somewhere around there?
Yeah, since 1526, when Cortez wrote a famous letter to the Emperor Charles V, when he described that he'd heard very reliable reports of this fabulously rich civilization in the interior of Honduras, but he was never able to go there. He was, you know, busy with conquering the Aztecs.
So. Oh, you know, maybe another day. So here's the thing. So in the early 1500s, this, you know, quest to discover the lost city began in so many ways. But now here we are, 2012, the technology exists to actually find this city. So what is the technology that you were able to use, and how does that work?
Well, it's called LIDAR, which is short for light detection and ranging.
Okay.
And it's really very similar to radar.
But you've used radar in the past and have never been able to find this city. So how does LIDAR differ from traditional radar technology?
Well, the radar technology was, they were using radar in as a way to try to penetrate and see through the jungle foliage. But LIDAR doesn't do that. The LIDAR plane, which was used, was brought down from the University of Houston, the National Center for Airborne Laser Mapping. And it has a million-dollar LIDAR machine in it, which, by the way, was built in, in Toronto.
Nice.
And this machine, when flown over the jungle, a canopy fires 125,000 laser pulses a second down into the canopy. And then it measures the reflections. And the laser doesn't penetrate anything. It just bounces off a leaf or a twig or whatever. But even in the thickest jungle, there are holes in the canopy. I mean, if you go into the thickest jungle and lie down on your back and look up at the sky, you will see bits and pieces of blue sky.
Okay.
The billions and billions of laser beams being fired into the jungle canopy find those holes, and some of them reach the ground, bounce off the ground, and come back up. And so what you get is a what the scientists call a point cloud, which is an incredible three-dimensional image of the rainforest. With every little reflection, every pixel is a reflection off a leaf or twig.
Okay.
And then using software, you can remove all those reflections from the trees, leaving just the ground reflections, and voila, there you have a map of the ground in quite high resolution. The resolution is about 1 meter. So that's not so bad.
So I'm picturing, as you're describing this, remember those toys that we had as kids that it had a whole bunch of pins on it, and you put it on your hand, and it would show the shape of your hand.
Yes.
So is the topography that you're looking at, is it very similar to that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's it's very hilly. By the way, I should talk a little bit about the environment. This is the thickest jungle in the world, but it lies on top of incredibly steep mountains that are almost impassable. And inside these mountains are valleys completely locked in that, because of their remoteness, have never been explored. They're some of the last unexplored places on Earth. And so what Steve Elkins decided was, in a total crapshoot, and I don't know how he convinced the scientists to go along with this, was to survey three of these unexplored valleys using LIDAR. And it cost $1 million. They had to fly a plane down from Houston. The technology has actually, some of it is classified. Military technology. It's the same technology used to guide cruise missiles to their targets. So the plane had to be guarded at all times by heavily armed soldiers while it was around. I mean, it was a serious effort. And, you know, honestly, the scientists who came down from NCOM were pretty skeptical. They thought it was just kind of crazy.
Yeah,
and they weren't really sure why they were doing it.
What a gamble! And, like, is this a self-funded expedition, or we're talking big money here to just take a risk and see, are we going to find something?
Yeah, exactly. Well, Steve raised the money from a wealthy documentary filmmaker named Bill Benenson, who was just so taken with the idea, and he does wonderful documentary film. So the idea was, look, if we find a lost city, we can do a documentary about it, and it'll be fabulously successful. And then Steve called me up and said, you're going to write about it for the New Yorker magazine. Well, I was so skeptical that I didn't even tell the New Yorker magazine that I was going down there.
I thought
to myself, I don't want to look like a damn fool when they don't find anything. So I thought, if they find something, I'll call the New Yorker, and if they don't find anything, well, maybe I can get a salvage a funny story out of it.
So what was that moment like when the LIDAR, the topography came in and the discovery was there? Like, what did you see? What was that moment like?
It was a crazy moment. It was a hilarious moment. The mapping scientist, the chief mapping scientist, was very laconic and skeptical. You know, he's a scientist. He was thought this was kind of crazy. And the data of 3 days of flying over Target 1, which was the first valley, was uploaded to Houston, crunched by computers there, and then downloaded back to Roatan. And it arrived early in the morning. And so this guy, Michael Sartori, took one look at it and just about had a fit. And he came running out of his bungalow, screaming and waving his arms, saying, "There's something in the valley! There's something in the valley!" And we all rushed in. And the funniest moment was when I saw his notebook, and he's a scientist. He's taking notes, meticulous notes about everything, endless notes. So under May 5th, 2012, which was the day of the discovery, he had only written two words: "Holy." I hope I can can say that on air. Anyway, so he turned from this skeptical scientist into kind of a raving Christopher Lloyd. It was hilarious.
Wow. Now, okay, so the technology, here we are, the technology exists and made this discovery possible. It's something that has been known about for thousands or hundreds of years, pardon me. And so now the technology's there, we've discovered it, and we're going to learn a little bit about the expedition itself, the ground expedition to actually go and seek out this lost city in just a couple of moments' time. First, we've got to take a really quick break. We're joined by Douglas Preston, the author of The Lost City of the Monkey God, A True Story. Stick around, don't go anywhere. Jeff Weston.
Yeah, man.
You're building a brand new, beautiful website.
What?
Aren't you?
No. Am I?
Oh, you're a terrible actor.
What?
This is where acting comes into play.
Oh, I didn't know we were acting.
You're supposed to act.
Okay, fair enough. All right.
Yeah, I'm building a really cool website. Are you building a really cool website? You need hosting. One of the things about a hosting account is you don't want to have limitations put on your website.
It's true.
How much hard drive space do you have? How many email accounts? How many domains can point to it? Well, we've got an amazing deal for you. For a very limited time, cat5.tv/dreamhost. For just $5 and a bit of change per month, you are going to get unlimited website hosting, unlimited email accounts on that hosting service. You are also going to receive a free domain name.
Ooh.
So your own .com.
Nice.
To put that amazing website that you've been working on
it's
on
true.
There. If you want to build a WordPress site, fine. Sign up. cat5.tv/dreamhost.
Just don't put Panama Papers on it.
Just don't do it. But hey, it's a great deal, folks. Best deal you're going to find. $5 and change per month. Go to cat5.tv/dreamhost. This is Category 5 Technology TV. Welcome to the show. Today we are speaking with Douglas Preston. He's the New York Times bestselling author and writer of the book, The Lost City of the Monkey God, A True Story. Make sure you check this out. It's available on Amazon or wherever you buy your books. We actually have a link for you just to make it nice and simple. You'll see it at the bottom of the screen there, and that'll take you to the book as well. Douglas, so nice to have you here joining us tonight, speaking about your discovery, your team's discovery of the Lost City of the Monkey God. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
So before the break, we were talking about the LIDAR technology, how that technology now exists to be able to discover something like the City of the Monkey God. So what was it like now that you've got this data, you've got this information, and here, a few years later, we're actually on the ground going to see what is actually there?
Well, an archaeological discovery really isn't made until you've ground truthed it. That's the term.
Yep.
So we knew there was a city there. We weren't, we had archaeologists who looked at these images and were absolutely floored, couldn't believe what they were looking at. And so we organized an expedition. This was a joint Honduran-American expedition, international. Actually, we had British, we had some Mexican archaeologists on it. And we went into the jungle in February of 2015.
Okay.
The only way to get in there was by helicopter. Mm-hmm. It would have taken weeks through overland travel to get in and would have been very dangerous, and not all of us would have survived. But, the Honduran Army dropped some special forces soldiers. They cleared a landing zone. Our helicopter landed. We made a very crude camp in the jungle. And then we began exploring the city. And there were 10 PhDs. On the expedition, three archaeologists, an anthropologist, some LIDAR engineers, and some logistics people, three ex-SAS British military jungle warfare experts whose goal was to keep us alive.
Mm.
And, they had warned us ahead of time. They gave us this huge lecture about this is the most dangerous place in the world and blah, wow. blah, blah. I was listening to this thinking, well, they're just trying to scare us. I spent a lot of time in my youth in wilderness areas, and I thought, well, I'm tough. I've seen this area from above. It looks more like a paradise.
And I feel like I have to ask Douglas, and then what happened?
Well, my arrogance was taken down more than a notch. In fact, it happened the very first night, shortly after I arrived. Night fell, and I was walking back from my hammock hung in the jungle and kind of with a flashlight, and I came across a gigantic Fer-de-Lance snake, coiled up, very aroused, in striking position, tracking me. I'd walked by it twice. And this is the deadliest snake in the New World. It kills more people than any other snake.
Wow.
It's very aggressive, will sometimes attack you and chase you and bite you several times, very much unlike a rattlesnake, which, you know, is, just wants to get away. It's about 1,000 times more toxic than a rattlesnake. So I said in a very calm voice, although others said I was yelling, I said in a very calm voice, "Hey, you guys, there's a really big snake over here." So the leader of the expedition, a British guy named Woody, came over and he said, "Oh, blimey, it's a Fer-de-Lance, one of the biggest ones I've ever seen. I'm going to move it." I thought, "Move it? I got to see this." So he cut a forked stick, he pinned the snake, and then it just exploded. It was striking everywhere. The venom was flying through the air. I mean, it was unbelievable, and the snake was bigger than he was.
Wow.
We hadn't really seen how big it was until it unrolled itself and thrashed about. So he wrestled the snake to the ground. He grabbed it behind its head. The snake was trying to bite him. It expelled venom all over the back of his hand. I saw his skin was bubbling. And finally, he managed to pin the snake, and he cut off its head.
Wow.
And even after he'd cut off its head, the headless snake continued to fight and tried to crawl off into the jungle, and the head continued biting and spitting and snapping, and it was like something out of a Stephen King horror novel.
And you remember all this. Now, see, I would have passed out long before the beheading. Yeah.
Well, it was funny because we had a National Geographic photographer there and a guy with a film camera, and both of them were so frozen in horror that they didn't get any of it. I said at a certain point, I said, "Hey, did any of you get that on film?" And they said, "Oh no! Oh my God!"
I can't even imagine. Oh my goodness.
But it was hilarious because the British guy, after all this was over and he'd washed the venom off, he said,
"Yeah,
nothing like that to concentrate the mind, is there?"
Wow.
So that was day one. This is initiation. Did you have any other frightening encounters or anything scary happen throughout the course of the expedition?
Well, there were a lot of unsettling things that happened. Like, for example, that night, a curious jaguar, came into camp and roamed among the tents, purring and, you know, kind of wondering. I was probably wondering who the heck we were.
Sure.
Very large animals, blundered around our tents, crashing and snapping twigs. I thought, aren't these animals supposed to be stepping delicately through the forest? But no, they were just like crashing around. So everyone was worried that one of them was going to step through a tent or something. But
right.
And then there was quicksand. We almost lost our anthropologist who was started to sink in this pool of quicksand.
Yikes.
She was very calm. She was quite remarkable. It was actually quite funny. She said, "Excuse me, I'm going down. I'm really going down."
And we, oh my goodness!
The bubbles are coming up. She's sinking. It's like something out of a B movie.
And oh boy! Like so Pat Yar and the
all around her snake gaiters, her snake guards had filled up with mud, and it was just literally sucking her under.
Oh no!
Wow!
Scary stuff. So,
and then the insects. I mean, that wouldn't even. You can't believe the insects. The first night I got into bed and I was exhausted, soaking wet because it rains all the time, and took off my clothes and lying there naked thinking, "Oh, thank God I've got those wet clothes off." And then I suddenly realized something I hadn't noticed before. My entire body was crawling with insects.
Oh, Douglas.
And I jumped up with a yelp. I said, "Oh my God, there are insects all over me." And I realized they were like tiny chiggers. They were like the size of a grain of sand, and they're like eating, burrowing into my flesh.
It's, oh my goodness.
I feel like they don't call it the Mosquito Coast for nothing.
What's that?
They don't call it the Mosquito Coast for nothing.
Yes, but here's the funny thing. That word does not come from the Spanish word for mosquito, which is mosca, little fly. It actually comes from the fact that the Indians in that area were supplied with muskets by the British to fight the Spanish. And the word musket in Spanish is mosquete, so they became known as the Mosquete Indians, now the Mosquito Indians. And, of course, that's the Mosquito Coast, or the La Mosquitia, which is the Spanish version of it. But that's not to say there aren't just a few mosquitoes there.
Wow.
Now, from there... So here you're at the camp. How far was it to get to where you discovered the lost city?
Well, we had to cross the river and climb up an incredibly steep embankment, which was so steep that actually they had to rig up fixed ropes on it, these guys. Mm-hmm. And then we were right there, and here was the pyramid right in front of us. The archaeologist with his LiDAR map is saying, there's the pyramid right there. And we were all staring at it, and we're saying, where? We don't see anything. All you could see were leaves. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was such a disappointment. The jungle was so thick, you couldn't see anything at all but leaves. And honestly, this jungle was so thick that if you put it down in Times Square and put yourself in the middle of it, you would not know that you were surrounded by tall buildings.
Wow.
That's so thick.
So we, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say we climbed the pyramid. We went all over. We didn't clear very much. The goal here was to be as unobtrusive as possible. Mm-hmm. And we just made wonderful discoveries of, I mean, the artifacts on the ground were spectacular. We couldn't believe.
Can you tell us a little bit about the, you know, what did you see? What did you find? And interestingly enough, as you say, artifacts on the ground and not even necessarily in the earth.
Well, it was interesting. The most amazing thing we found quite a lot of stuff, all very deeply buried, just the peeking out. But the most amazing thing we found was at the base of the pyramid, a cache of 52 stone sculptures, beautiful stone sculptures, just the heads of which were peeking above the ground.
Wow.
And the first thing I saw was a jaguar head coming out of the ground, snarling jaguar, beautifully carved. And it was covered with moss and wet with the rain. And the mist was drifting through the trees. And then as I looked in the twilight, I could see the heads of other sculptures peeking up, vulture heads and monkeys and snakes. And it was such an electrifying moment. Well, first, everyone's yelling and shouting, actually, you know. But for the first time, I really realized, wow, these people are real. I suddenly felt an emotional connection to them, whereas before it was all this sort of lost city, very sort of theoretical. All of a sudden, I realized these people were amazing. They made beautiful objects. They were powerful people. They were self-assured. They were confident.
Do we know anything about the people who lived in this city or in this area?
You know, it's not really. The Honduran archaeologist with us, I asked him that question. He said, yeah. Well, what we know about these people is nothing.
Really?
So, but we do know something. They
entirely shrouded in mystery and time just wiping a civilization away.
It's true. They grew up, the civilization grew up in the frontier of the Maya. So they adopted a lot of aspects of Maya culture, including the famed Mesoamerican ball game, which, you know, where the losers sometimes lost their heads. Mm. They built pyramids and they laid out their cities like the Maya, somewhat.
Okay.
But built it earth and stone and adobe and wood instead of in cut stone and cut limestone like the Maya. So their cities did not survive as beautifully intact as the Maya did.
So what makes the city of the monkey god so stand out and so exciting compared to some other discoveries?
Well, the probably the most interesting and unusual thing about it is that almost all discoveries, I put that in quotes, discoveries of ancient cities in Central America were not made by archaeologists. The indigenous people knew where they were all along and brought the archaeologists there to show these ruins to them. And that's how they were discovered.
I gotcha.
So all these other cities that have been discovered have been disturbed. They've been looted. Stuff has been dug up. They've been tramped around. Even curious people hundreds of years ago were taking these things and putting them in their houses, you know, sculptures. They look pretty cool.
Right.
This city was totally untouched. The inhabitants of this city walked out, and the next human beings to walk in were us. And so it was beautifully intact from an archaeological perspective, even though it had suffered the ravages of time. So when this cache of objects was excavated, all the objects were in their original position, except from the falling of trees, some had been displaced.
Okay.
It revealed enormously important information about this culture, why they placed these objects here, and what the objects meant.
Wow. So we're talking about a completely unlooted archaeological excavation. Is that in the plans, or is this going to be dug up and explored?
Well, just the cache was dug up because here are objects worth, you know, millions of dollars. Okay. And the Honduran army was guarding the site, but you can't guard it forever. And it was also the Hondurans were very excited by the discovery. They wanted to show the objects off, and they also wanted to study them. Mm-hmm. So they excavated just 200 square feet of the cache down to 18 inches. That's it. Wow. And they brought out 500 sculptures, which are now on display. Some are in the National Museum. Most of them are being curated and studied by archaeologists at a new laboratory built nearby. Well, I say nearby, you know, in the closest city, which is, you know, 100 miles away. Mm-hmm. And then there are a few right now actually in the American Embassy so that American visitors really? Can enjoy.
Okay. And are these large artifacts? Like, what are we talking about as far as what are the artifacts that are on display?
Well, they're not gigantic. Probably the largest ones may weigh are stone urns that weigh maybe 300 or 400 pounds. Okay. I'd say most of them can be picked up by two really strong people.
Okay.
They consist of these great urns and also seats, which were thrones of power. They believe. They're not sure what really? They were for, but they were stone seats decorated with animals like jaguars and snakes and monkeys. And they were believed to be seats of power where a shaman would sit in the seat and through the use of hallucinogenic drugs would put himself in touch with the animal that he represented.
Okay.
It's kind of a way to tap into the power of the jaguar or of the vulture or of the snake.
Interesting.
And so they were sort of religious, sacred objects.
So how much would you say technology is what made possible the discovery of the Lost City?
Well, I would say it was probably about 100%.
Really?
Because it's really hard to imagine anyone getting into that valley to explore and being able to find this stuff in the thickest jungle. Without actually tripping over these sculptures. I mean, you could walk by through the river, walk by the city 100 times, and you didn't have no idea that there was anything there. So it was really the technology was what did it. And in fact, LIDAR technology is transforming archaeology. One archaeologist compared it to the advent of carbon-14 dating, saying it was a revolution in archaeology. For the first time, you could map with incredible precision archaeological sites down to centimeter precision in a few days.
Nuts. Now, are there plans with this technology to, like, this is something very specific to, you were saying, military, and it's not something that's mass available.
No, it isn't, and it's very expensive.
The price is very high. That's it.
Yeah, you have to fly a plane. The operation of the equipment is very high, and also one of the technological challenges that I didn't mention earlier, but that's pretty cool, is that the plane itself has to keep track of its position in three-dimensional space every second to within an inch as it's flying.
Wow.
Now, that's a lot more than what GPS can provide.
Yeah.
And so that's where the classified military technology comes in. There's a sealed can inside the LIDAR machine, which it's a felony to open this can. It's called an inertial measurement unit, and it's the same technology that's used in guiding cruise missiles to their target. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it measures every inertial movement of the plane, every pitch, yaw, bump, you know, all the turbulence and everything else, and is able to, through really powerful computing, able to locate the position of the plane in three-dimensional space to within an inch. Because obviously the resolution of the ground can't be greater than the knowledge of the plane's position in space. If your technical audience will understand why that is. Otherwise, you know, if the plane's bouncing around 3 or 4 meters at a time, you're not going to get a resolution better than 3 or 4 meters.
Right. And but planes are, you know, you're going to intercept turbulence and things like that. So it could be a little bit of a logistical nightmare, I would think, to be that pilot. I think it'd be pretty tough. But is this a technology pretty tough? There's an understatement. Yeah, impossible for Robbie. Is this a technology that is, like, is it a giant LiDAR device, or is this something that could eventually find its way to, say, a drone-type system that could be flown from the ground?
Well, I'll tell you, that's very interesting. The miniaturization of LiDAR is proceeding at a tremendous pace. And in fact, LiDAR is what is going to be used in self-driving vehicles, not radar.
Really?
Much more accurate. It is much more precise. And, the wavelength of laser light is much shorter than of radar light. So, you just get a better image. And this is the basis of the lawsuit between, I believe it's Uber and Google, or Uber and Apple, about the use of LiDAR in self-driving vehicles. There's a big lawsuit that just was filed about this technology. Mm-hmm. But it's extraordinary. They mapped, LiDAR is not a new technology. They mapped the surface of the moon with it. They mapped the surface of Mars using LiDAR. But the accuracy of it, the fine-tuning of it, and the resolution of it is dramatically increased.
Okay. And that sounds exciting to me, because you're on this threshold of this technology becoming something that may be more readily available to archaeologists and even, to the point of hobbyists. Eventually, we're going to possibly see that from what you're saying, because the driving technology behind the cars, it's going to get more accurate. It's going to get smaller and cheaper as they mass manufacture this stuff. So maybe, potentially, that's something that we would see.
Now, does LiDAR... Is it only something that works, above ground, or could you use it for underwater expeditions as well, or would the water mess with the lasers?
Well, that's a great question. They're actually developing an underwater LiDAR, and it's a special green wavelength of light that passes through water more readily than other wavelengths, but it only penetrates about 40 feet before
Okay.
Incoherent, and you don't get a good reflection. But 40 feet is a lot. I mean, if you tow a device on the surface of the ocean, or even tow it, LiDAR works in pitch darkness as well. So you could take these things and tow them, over the seabed and make an incredibly accurate map of the seabed that's far more accurate than anything that side scan, sonar, or anything could do.
Sure, and they could submerge the technology itself. Now, is it safe? Are there any risks to using LiDAR?
It's totally safe. This is an infrared, invisible to the human eye. It's infrared laser beams, which don't have any effect on plant life or animals or anything. You can't even see it.
Wow.
So it's totally harmless.
Okay, I gotcha.
Now, you were talking about the technology within the plane for knowing exactly how the plane is moved. Was special software built to integrate that into the LiDAR topography, or were they separate programs that ran and then you coordinated the numbers? How did you sync that stuff up?
Well, that's a very good technical question, and it's the heart of the whole thing. There are three different systems for locating that plane in space. The first is a regular GPS in the plane, which locates it to within about 10 feet.
Okay.
It's a standard GPS. Then they place ground units on the ground, fixed points on the ground, which are communicating directly with a GPS satellite. And that data is collected while the plane is in flight. And then those two data sets are combined, and that gives you an accuracy of a little bit less than a foot of a position in space. And then the IMU unit, which is handling all the turbulence and the bouncing around, fills in the rest to give you the centimeter resolution that LiDAR is capable of now.
Wow.
That's so cool.
And the LiDAR we used just in 2012 was shooting 125,000 laser beams a second. The latest LiDAR machines are shooting six times that number now.
Unbelievable.
So it's just tremendous computing power that's required to analyze all those laser beams and returns, because a single laser beam can sometimes give you two or three returns.
Right.
So you're dealing with billions and billions of points that have to be mapped digitally.
I could talk about this for hours. This is so fascinating. This is right up my alley. I love this.
It's taken me to new worlds in technology and what this could be used for. And
oh, I know.
It's fantastic.
I love it.
We're speaking tonight with Douglas Preston. He's the author of The Lost City of the Monkey God, A True Story. Make sure you go to cat5.tv/monkeygod and you can pick up your copy today. Douglas, it has been a fantastic pleasure having you here joining us on Category 5 Technology TV tonight. Before we wrap up, there was a curse that was mentioned about the city of the monkey god. Are you some, you know, when you went in and, you know, the first night, snake attack, you know, scary stuff, all the stuff that happened, are you one who believes in these curses?
Well, I didn't believe in these curses at all. Just the basic sort of legend is that all who visit the lost city of the monkey god will fall ill and die. Well, you know, who believes that kind of stuff?
Yeah, okay.
Last time I checked, we all end up dying, so.
Right. Anyway, yeah, it's true, 100% true statement. But it turns out that legends are often based in the truth, and the valley of T1 was a hot zone of disease, a virulent hot zone of disease, of a really terrible deadly tropical disease called mucosal leishmaniasis. And two-thirds of the expedition came down with this disease. We didn't realize it until about 2 months after the end of the disease. It's incurable. It is horrible. I'd be delighted to discuss your listeners with a description of its symptoms.
Maybe we should look it up. We'll post a link below. I almost fainted when you started talking about the snake. So
don't Google it. It's a flesh-eating parasite, which is, it's also called white leprosy, and it migrates to your nose and lips eats them away until they fall off, leaving a weeping open sore where your face used to be.
Oh my goodness.
And then, untreated, the disease continues to eat away at the bones of your face until there's just a hole, and then you die.
Oh, yikes.
Now, that will not happen to us. Unfortunately, I was one of the people who got the disease. It's very difficult to cure. It's a very interesting disease. I mean, as a journalist, I couldn't be happier with getting this interesting disease.
Oh, my.
in the sense that I can write about it, not happy that
not
I have
one of
it.
Those boring diseases.
I know, like malaria. I mean, everyone gets malaria. That's really important. Dinosaurs got leishmaniasis. I mean, they found a piece of amber with a sand fly in it that had sucked dinosaur blood, and in this blood were leishmania parasites, fossilized, you know, preserved in the amber.
Wow.
So it's the oldest disease that we know of. It's a very complex single-celled animal. It's not a virus or a bacterium.
A single-celled animal.
Wow.
Yeah.
I can see your wonderful face, which means that it didn't progress too far with you, but does that mean that you're cured, or?
No, it's remarkable what they can do with plastics these days. That's a joke, sorry.
I didn't know how to respond to that. I'm like, wow, they did a great job.
Wow, you look so real.
I looked closer at your nose.
The National Institutes of Health became very interested in our disease. They're studying it. They have the finest leishmania laboratory in the world, where they're breeding the sand flies, and they have infected mice, and they're trying to come up with a vaccine or some kind of treatment for it. And so we all got treated there for free. We became part of a medical study. The doctors just loved us. And it's not curable, but it can be controlled. And, you know, I'm in better shape than, I have to say, unfortunately, some of my compatriots on the expedition are in much worse shape, and one is really very ill, and we're really worried about him. You know, I don't mean to make light of this. It's just...
No, absolutely. No, I understand. And
yeah, but it's just from a journalistic point of view, it's a very interesting medical mystery.
Right, I hear you. Yeah.
It turns out the kind of leash that we got is really unknown. They sequenced the genome. They found a new species. So,
unreal. Well, you can read all about the expedition, about the experience that Douglas, our guest tonight, has gone through with the expedition. This is The Lost City of the Monkey God, and Douglas Preston joining us tonight. He's a New York Times best-selling author. Douglas, it has been a pleasure having you here. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Well, thanks. It's been great to be on this show.
All the best.
All right.
Take care.
Thank you.
This is Category 5 Technology TV, and thank you so much for joining us tonight. You can find our website at www.category5.tv. Lots of fun having Douglas on the show. Make sure you go check out his book at cat5.tv/monkeygod.